of transcendent knowledge. Thus, what I heard, once the Blessed One was dwelling in Rajagriha at Vulture Peak Mountain, together with a great gathering of the Sangha of monks and a great gathering of the Sangha of Bodhisattvas. At that time, the Blessed One entered the Samadhi that expresses the Dharma called profound illumination. At the same time, Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, while practicing the profound Prajnaparamita, saw in this way. He saw the five skandhas to be empty of nature. Then through the power of the Buddha, Venerable Shariputra said to Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, how should a son or daughter of noble family train who wishes to practice the profound Prajnaparamita? Addressed in this way, Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, said to Venerable Shariputra, O Shariputra, son or daughter of noble family who wishes to practice the profound Prajnaparamita should see in this way. Seeing the five skandhas to be empty of nature. Form is emptiness. Emptiness also is form. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is no other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness are emptiness. Thus, Shariputra, all dharmas are emptiness. There are no characteristics. There is no birth and no cessation. There is no impurity and no purity. There is no decrease and no increase. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no perception, no formation, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no appearance, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no dharmas, no eye dhatu, up to no mind dhatu, no dhatu of dharmas, no mind consciousness dhatu, no ignorance, no end of ignorance, up to no old age and death, no end of old age and death, no suffering, no origin of suffering, no cessation of suffering, no path, no wisdom, no attainment, no non-attainment. Therefore, Shariputra, since the Bodhisattvas have no attainment, they abide by means of Prajnaparamita. Since there is no obscuration of mind, there is no fear. They transcend falsity and attain complete nirvana. All the Buddhas of the three times by means of Prajnaparamita fully awaken to unsurpassable true complete enlightenment. Therefore, the great mantra of Prajnaparamita, the mantra of great insight, the unsurpassed mantra, the unequaled mantra, the mantra that calms all suffering should be known as truth, since there is no deception. The Prajnaparamita mantra is said in this way. Teyata om gate gate paragate parasangati bodhisoha. Thus Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, should train in the profound Prajnaparamita. Then the Blessed One arose from that samadhi and praised Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, saying, good, good, O son of noble family. Thus it is, O son of noble family. Thus it is. One should practice the profound Prajnaparamita just as you have taught, and all the Tathagatas will rejoice. When the Blessed One had said this, Venerable Shariputra and Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, that whole assembly in the world with its gods, humans, asuras, and gandharvas rejoiced and praised the words of the Blessed One. Gala jube ne jo dhamma ne kushe du chu nga yi du do je druba bo lama yi pushin si ne zong gan ro zo la ja ze lo agasamare te shan ero samare be agasamare te shan ero samare be agasamare te shan ero samare be agasamare te shan ero samare be. Aga samara ka janara samara yame de ada om kate kate para kate para sangate bodhi so a papa konche sanji gai tem be to chi baba to chi baba to chi wa to chi nagi baje me dem be jan chi ding ko ye so ke rin don ja bi chi chi wa da mi don be jan da jo wa da to ba jo chi kun sun sun jo chi ta chi je jan den da de le sho. The fundamental ground is scented with incense and strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, the four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha land and offer it. May all sentient beings enjoy this pure realm. Holy Lamas high, wrap the sky of your Dharma bodies in massive clouds of knowledge and love, and let them pour upon the earth of your disciples as we are ready, a shower of rain, the teachings deep and wide. Yeah. send forth this jewel mandala to you, precious Guru. Hiyadam Guru Radha Mandala Gamni Radha Yami. Sanjay. Chidan Jodi Janam La Janju Badu Dani Jazu Ji Dagi Chinin Ji Pisanan Ji Jala Benji Sanji Jubajo Sanji Chidan Jodi Janam La Janju Badu Dani Jazu Ji Dagi Chinin Ji Pisanan Ji Jala Benji Sanji Jubajo Sanji Chidan Jodi Janam La Janju Badu Dani Jazu Ji Nagi chinyin ji besanan ji jala benji sanye ju ba sho. Rinpoche, the chu get chu konga yore, the tashi de le, la? So here we are, Rinpoche, the Ngachi Se Papi Chewa, the George, the Chu the Geji She, the Ngachi Garigu, the Dirbe. Okay, so I asked Rinpoche if he'd like to say anything today about the greatness of the author to explain the noble origin, within that topic a little bit. And he said he'd like me to explain what we've talked about. So we've talked a lot about a lot of things this week, intermittently. So I'd like to share some of those things with you. And another thing I've been finding that's kind of neat, and this is not something to be like doubtful on, because I hear it almost whenever you hear a live translation, any translator, you find little pockets of things that are being missed, right? So I've been going back to the old teachings, Roy's teachings, my teachings, all these teachings, and finding these little pockets of like the, you know, the B-sides or what, you know, like these little pockets that weren't ever kind of talked about or kind of put in ways that maybe weren't. Here's an interesting thing. Here's an interesting point to it. We were in just an interesting story over the years. We were in Indiana. We went to Indiana to go, Rinpoche gave a Heart Sutra teaching in Indiana and Roy translated it. Now, at that time I was involved in a lot of like social work type stuff and help, you know, helping others, you know, and with addiction and stuff like that. So at that time, someone that I was working with became a very close friend of mine, got into some trouble and had some problems. And he needed, you know, he wasn't out really long. He needed to go somewhere for a while and get away, really, mostly. Maybe a hospital would have been better, but we chose to do the following. So I had to leave for Indiana in a couple of days and my friend, you know, was in trouble. So I asked Rinpoche if he could come, which he did to the Dalai Lama's brother's house in the car with Roy and myself, my 98 Jetta doing 100 miles an hour, probably if I had to guess, with big loud speakers blaring right back then. And we brought my friend to Indiana who was detoxing, you know, not terribly, terribly so, but very uncomfortable. And we got to Indiana and Rinpoche is giving the Heart Sutra teaching. And Rinpoche is talking about, you know, layperson's vows, something around this area and talking about not drinking. And you know, how, you know, not drinking or, you know, using things that could cause you problems. Then he stops and I know he must have been looking at my friend because he knew what was going on. And he said, and we also have to be very careful with not using drugs. He said, because drugs make you feel really good at first and you think that it solves all of your problems. And then you need them only to just live and survive. And then it becomes your only problem and main problem. Now he said this like very clearly during this teaching, you know, to Greg, he was talking about addiction, very clearly, and it kind of went over the translation. Just kind of said, "Yeah, you shouldn't do these things. It's bad for you." But Rinpoche really broke down about how, well, at first it really seems like it's something that's good for you, and seems like it feels really good, and it works for that initially, he said. But then, after that initial phase, in order to just be at where you were before you started, you need it. And then it becomes a problem because then you need it, right? And then you have to try to obtain it, and it's very expensive. So he really gave this very clear description. And I was so shocked when I went back and listened to this teaching. You know, I was listening to the Heart Sutra teaching from like 2000 or something that Brian sent over. And I was just so amazed to just hear how Rinpoche was teaching to every scope in the room at all times, and how there are all these little kind of things in there that I'm now picking up on that were really key points. This was just an example of something that was missed, but there's other things that are real key universal points that I find were really going to be helpful that I'm going to try to integrate into some of these commentaries. When I find them in a commentary where it wasn't mentioned, where Rinpoche gave it, then I can add it into the commentary, right? Now that's being given in that exact section. So it's kind of neat. So enough about that story. I just think there's so many funny stories. Sometimes I want, you know, like to go back and tell them. And it was really, that person today is retiring to go live in San Diego and, you know, is doing very, very well for themselves. So the story also ends really nicely. I just found this out like 4 months ago. I got in touch with this person. I was like, "Hey, you remember we did that thing? You know, how are you?" And he's doing great. You know, he, you know, really, really beyond great, retiring at my age. So did a good job. So anyway, so why are we studying Atisha, right? Why? I was thinking about this and talking with Rinpoche about this. Like last week, we talked about these liberation life stories. And why do we study them? Because it gives us encouragement and so forth. But what does it mean, you know, to be part of a lineage? When you think of this, I was thinking like, you know, in the, say, for instance, we were related to George Washington, right? We'd like walk around, put a plaque on our house and say like, "Oh, I'm from the family of George Washington," right? Like it mattered or something. We have some famous cousin or something. Like we would really like, or if our great grandmother was like some famous person, or our grandfather was some famous person, we could talk about them and be so inspired and think that we have these genes, right? We have these genes to be able to do these great things, like, and we can, you know, because of these great people in our family or these great people, we are inspired by them, right? We feel that this is part of us. Well, that's kind of what's happening, right? When we look at this lineage, when we look at the instructions that are passed down, we become part of this lineage that's not broken, that goes all the way back to the Buddha. So when we look at these great masters that we talk about, right? When we look at the Kadampa masters, when we look at the overview of like how the Lam Rim gets to us and all of these teachers that we talk about and we wonder about, and we have to ask ourselves why. So we hear about these teachers like Sharawa and Potawa, right? All these masters within the Kagyu and Sakya lineages, and we have to, and Gampopa, right? Why are these people famous? Why are we talking about these people? Why are we talking about their liberation life stories? Well, when we look at them, we find out it's because Sharawa was a student of Potawa. And why is Potawa famous? Because Potawa was a student of Atisha. Of Drontompa, rather, or Atisha, however you want to look at it. And Drontompa is famous because he was a student of Atisha. So when we talk about these liberation life stories, it's like our family in a sense, if you will, right? Because we talk about them in terms of lineage, like Gelsabje and Kirtabje. They're only great because they're the sons of Tsongkhapa, right? So we are the sons and daughters of Kensar Geshe Wandak. What does that mean? That means that we go all the way back to the Buddha in an unbroken lineage. We have transmissions of texts that we read from those authors. We have transmissions of the Waitara initiation that really comes from Dapo. If we look at Dapo to Pabunka to Trijung to Zong to everyone, Dapo,
that great meditator in the cave is in our family, right? Dapo. That is our lineage. That is, if we become Buddhists based on these instructions, it will be the same things that they're doing. The things that impress them impress us. It's like what we're taught by our family is what we should hold true, is what these lineage teachers teach us. And we become part of that. We become part of that ability to become enlightened because of the fact that it is unbroken, because it's a lineage, because there's no faulty instructions. So this is what's so beautiful about it. So when we talk about Atisha's liberation life story, we say, oh, well, Atisha's, you know, looking back on these other texts, Atisha had 150 gurus, right? Atisha had all of these teachers that we're now like learning from. Atisha took the ocean of the teachings of Sutra and Tantra, right? Hold on one second. I have to get another dog out. This is dog number two I've expelled. Come on, come on. Let's go. So we have to have a little courage, right? Like the reason I'm saying this is like, there's a whole part in the perfection of patience section. I've been looking at the Lam Rim as a totality lately and seeing like, is this cause and effect? And it just rings true every time. Every time I get to the later section, Tsongkhapa's like, oh, I mentioned that before. Make sure you know that or this won't work. I mean, he's really like, I almost want to count how many times Lama Tsongkhapa says, if you don't have this thing before what I'm talking about, no chance this is going to happen. And you actually might make it worse for yourself, right? Like, and he goes into the pitfalls that can happen if you don't have the earlier realization. So I'm really just finding this beautiful web that all interconnects, but interconnects in a direction of cause and effect from the small scope all the way to the highest yoga tantra. I mean, it's so clear when you study the four tantra sets and you study the sutras, the perfection vehicle, and you look at all of it as an overview and look at the Lam Rim. It's just so clearly and beautifully written. And Atisha, so kind to us, right? For taking all of these sutras and all of these tantras, all of the Hinayana, hearer and solitary realizer teachings and bodhisattva teachings and putting them in order into a pathway that we can practice. And that is so amazing that not only do we have a lineage, right? But we have a lineage that presents it in that stainless fashion. So Atisha presents this beautiful, illustrious path to a group of very confused Buddhists. That's what was happening. There was a group of very confused Buddhists in Tibet at the time who had, you know, received these very, very high esoteric teachings. And they really weren't prepared to interpret them because they didn't have the real basis of those five texts and the understanding of what differentiates this from this. What is sutra? What is tantra? Why does tantra rely on sutra? Why are the ethics of sutra required for the ethics of tantra? Like all of these things were misguided and misunderstood. And the view of emptiness was just trashed in Tibet at that time. The view of emptiness was nihilism, substantialism. You know, there were a lot of meditations on space that made your mind like that. It was just like the Hashan view. So Atisha showed up in a very confused Buddhist place. And I kind of feel like we're here in the West right now. Like we don't, like it, maybe it's not like as, no, we're here in the West right now because you can find all of these things being presented as actual absolute reality. And there isn't really an authoritative source, right? In Western Buddhism, you know, or, you know, whatever you would want to call it. I hate to say authoritative, but it's kind of a free for all here right now with pockets of not free for all. And I was talking to Lori this morning. I just pray that we can have a monastic institution in the West that studies these five texts and debates. Because we need that. We need that so badly. We need scholars that are focused scholars that tore this information apart in an order, right? in a specific order and has a specific skill set of information that is just so clean and presentable that they can help us to kind of, you know, clear away some of these misconceptions that we have coming into the Dharma in the West that I see. It's not important. It just, I see it happening in my limited viewpoint. I see a lot of buffet Buddhism happening. I see a lot of taking from this and taking from that and making psychology. And I see a lot of misguided representation of the Buddhist path going on. And that's just my opinion. But the only way we'll find out if it's true or not is if we look at Atisha's text, we look at the Lamrim teachings that follow, look at all those commentaries, and look at Atisha's text backwards into the authentic Indian commentaries, become scholars ourselves, and then say whether what we're hearing is in line from a total path perspective or not. I don't mean isn't Buddhism, meaning like things are being stated, right? And are all over the place about this topic, a lot of topic studies in the West, this topic. And it even says in the Lamrim Chemo that at that time, there was so much more teaching on emptiness and concentration. And then the other four perfections were like missing. Like, like they're like, everybody just wanted to learn meditation and emptiness. And nobody was focusing on what is the perfection of ethics? What is the perfection of generosity? What is the perfection of patience? What is the perfection of effort? So Lama Tsongkhapa said, at the time when he wrote the Lamrim Chemo, it seemed like that's what was going on. Everybody just wanted to talk about emptiness and concentration, and nobody wanted to talk about the things that make that happen. So what I find beautiful is that we don't have to have opinions, right? We have texts. We have authoritative texts that we can look to and see whether or not what we're practicing is a complete path or not. I'm not questioning whether these are Buddhist principles. I'm questioning whether they are being presented in a complete path context, which will actually work. And Lama Tsongkhapa says, if it isn't a complete path, it's not a complete path. It won't lead to the destination that you're looking for. And it can also cause you to move away from your destination because it's incomplete. You get to a place of confidence. It's Lama Tsongkhapa says in this text, it's incredible. He says, you get into this perfection of patience section, right? And it says that, you know, you can have this patient, you have to be patient with yourself. You know, you can be discouraged of that this is just too vast. He said, but most people, when they're discouraged, or they aren't at that kind of discouragement, right? Like they don't get discouraged about the fact that it's vast because they're only practicing what's comfortable for them. So they think they've mastered it and they get this confidence of non-discouragement and this pride that's wrong, this ignorant pride, this unwise pride, this I haven't studied anything and let me tell you how to meditate. Lama Tsongkhapa and the great Kadampa masters, you find it, Kagyu masters, everybody, they say the best meditators are the best teachers. Inferior meditators teach inferior teachings because they don't know how to explain the five texts. So they don't know how to meditate on the five texts. They don't know how to meditate on the five texts. They've got an incomplete pass, and they're going to pass something along to you wrong. And that's what it says in this text, and it's what's so beautiful about it. Find out. Use the mirror of the Dharma to see if that's the case. So we're studying. We see that this Lamrim teaching is just this vast teaching, right, with so much information. But there's also just so much encouragement in the Lamrim that talks about, like, starting from where you're at and being inspired with the fact that we all have Buddha nature, right? We all are just like Buddhas. We're all just like Atisha. We're all just like Drontompa. We're all just like Potawa. We're all just like Sharawa. We're all just like Marpa. We're all just like these beings. There's no difference except we read their story and they practiced the path and then became enlightened, but they had the same afflictions that we have exactly. There were no difference in the quality of the people they were, right? The quality of the samsaric beings that they were. They had attachment, they had hatred, they had ignorance, they had all of these things. But what did they do? Well, we look at Anamtar. We look at a liberation life story. What did they do about it? You know, did they go to a class and then be satisfied with that? Did they go to once a week to a class and then not study all week and then go back to that class? Did they go once a month to a class? You know, what did they do? What did they do? If we want to be Buddhists, if we want to realize these things that we study, if we're dissatisfied with what we, who we are and what we have, right? In sense of at an ultimate level of having to be born and age and get sick and die, all of these things, right? We have to look to what we have to do to make it stop, right? And we can make it stop now or make it stop later, but it's not going to stop until we make it stop. You know, I was looking at the teaching Rinpoche gave on the lamp, and he says the afflictions are going to come up if you haven't abandoned them. So what's the cause of an affliction happening? That you haven't abandoned it, right? So if you haven't abandoned the afflictions, they're going to come up. And there's specific antidotes to these afflictions that we have that cause us to suffer. And if we don't know what they are and we don't know how to apply them, they're going to come up because we haven't abandoned them. It's a true sign that we will suffer again. We have attachment at death. We will suffer again. We will be reborn into appropriated aggregates. We'll be thrust into aggregates. So what did Atisha do? Atisha, you know, snuck out of the palace where he could enjoy every pleasure he could ever have, you know, and we can look at this in a figurative literal, however we need to. This is what he did. He left all the pleasures he could because he knew what real pleasure was. So in the Lam Rim, in the Six Perfections section, it talks about how bodhisattvas have joy in doing spiritual things. They find joy in practicing the other perfections. You know, they have this joyous perseverance. It's like when children are playing and they don't want to stop playing because they get that result of the play is like that fun, right? The play and then fun, play fun. That's how bodhisattvas are with practicing the path. It's that fun. It's like that much joy, like a little child. Like I look at like Kala, the little dog running around with its toys all morning, like just having like, oh, let me grab that toy. That'll be fun. A bodhisattva engages in virtue because that's what's fun to them. That's what they know really produces happiness. Like what we do when we think we're going to have some fun. How many times have like when you're younger or now even you go out and like, this is going to be a good night. We're going out. We're going to have some fun, right? And then the night's not fun at all. You did all these things to try to go have fun. The result isn't what you expected it to be. If we practice the Buddhism path, if the bodhisattvas practice the bodhisattva path, the result's always what they expect it to be. Happiness, bliss. So this is what really motivated these great beings, was studying the preliminary introductory teachings of understanding this human basis that we have and being so grateful to have it and recognizing that it's going to be gone. And what happens when it's gone? Well, the things I did will follow behind me. And what are they going to produce? Happiness and suffering. So the bodhisattva's desire to have this joyous perseverance comes from something very specifically. And it's very clear in the Lam Rim what it comes from. And, you know, you would think that, you know, maybe it comes from, you know, hold on one second. So anyway, you would think that this joyous perseverance, right, comes from, you know, something that, you know, has to do with this limitless compassion. Yes, it does. It does. But what does Lama Tsongkhapa talk about when he says, how do you start to make the factors for joyous perseverance? What do you need to do? What do you think that might be? You know, is it a fancy meditation on, the concentration levels? No, he says right here, if you want to stop the laziness of procrastination, you have to meditate on the three root death meditation. It's like way in the perfection of joyous perseverance. Lama Tsongkhapa is still talking about the three roots and the nine reasons. You know, we will definitely die. We don't know when. And the only thing that can help us is Dharma. So that meditation is what causes joyous perseverance. So what caused Atisha to know that he needed to practice. It's this familiarity with death and impermanence, familiarity with karma and its results, familiarity. You know, how do you develop patience in here? You know, you go back to patience. Well, what do you need to develop patience? You need to understand karma and its results. Because if you understand karma and its results, you realize that the person's under, if someone's being mean to you and you want to have patience for them, you understand that they're under the control of their afflictions. They are not, you know, independent. They don't have free will, as we talk about. They're under control of their karma and afflictions. So then, oh man, we feel bad for them. But then there's another part that we're causing it also. We're causing them to create non-virtue that makes them suffer. We are causing their suffering because previously we created the causes for them to show up. They couldn't show up if we didn't create those causes. So if we don't understand karma very, very clearly, and we don't understand, you know, what is to be abandoned and what is to be taken on, then we won't have any idea how to practice these later things. We won't have any idea how as a bodhisattva to generate patience by understanding that this thing coming at us, right, is just a collection of parts. So the bodhisattva studied emptiness. So this person who's angry yelling at me is a collection of parts I'm naming as an angry person, right? I'm believing it comes from its own side, but it doesn't. It doesn't have any kind of independence because it's under the influence of karma. It's dependently originating under the influence of karma. Couldn't be anything else. And I'm making it occur because I'm under the influence of karma and I'm projecting it. My completing karma is making me experience this. So the Lam Rim is cause and effect. And the Lam Rim really requires the previous realizations to be understood. And that's why when we hear these liberation life stories, we have to understand that these beings, if they were doing these fantastic, wonderful things, and they had all this effort, they must have had to have the cause for it. If a teacher had 150 to teach students and was sneaking out to go get teachings and showing back up, acting crazy to try to get, you know, his duties, you know, relinquished, he really, really must have studied those preliminary teachings, those teachings that are shared in common with beings of small and great capacity. And you see in the Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, he mentions those two sections as just kind of a summary, right? But you know, based on the later realizations, if you study cause and effect, that all of the things in the greater Lam Rims that we study, you study the Jewel Ornament for Liberation, Gampopa's texts, or you study the Lam Rim Chemo, Lama Tsongkhapa's texts, or any of the other hundreds probably of Lam Rim commentaries that are out there. Now, even in a contemporary sense, there's so many commentaries out there. I lost my train of thought, but that's fine. So when we look back at all of these teachings and we see that the masters that practice these teachings went about it in a very specific way. Atisha went about it in a very specific way. He didn't dilly-dally. He went and got teachings about everything there ever was to be done. And when we look at the Kadampa lineage of Potawa to Sharawa, you know, Sharawa, when he's talking about wisdom, he says, you know, if we are looking at, you know, when we stop studying, right? When does it when do we stop picking up a book and looking at the meaning of things? And Sharawa says, until you become a Buddha, your studies aren't finished, right? They are not finished. They're finished when you're a Buddha. So that's the lineage we're under, right? We're a part of a lineage that says, like, you really need to study this material and to understand it. It says, even if you do not understand the teachings from the outset, don't be discouraged, but strive to study them in accordance with your mental capacity as much as feasible, whether that be little or a lot. Don't make study and practice separate things. So it's really, you know, this need for analysis is so great when it comes to our ability to have joyous perseverance, right? And have the perfection of patience, you know, because there's tools that we need to use in order to be patient, right? And that's what the Lam Rim is teaching us, right? Before we get to great compassion, we learn how to you know, equally want to help friends, enemies, and neutrals. You know, all of these things are a web that cause one another. And that's really what I wanted to present today, is just this importance of study. It isn't just a Galupa thing. When we look at the authentic teachings and all of the lineages, we have the scriptural lineage, the Lamrim lineage, and the secret lineage of the Lamrim, right? From Atisha. There was a vast amount of studying that was found to be necessary in the scriptural Lamrim lineage, and even in the just Lamrim lineage, the one that was more condensed study of the Lamrims, they were still studying an immense amount every single day, and trying to make their afflictions a little bit less that day. Shantideva talks about when we talk about what we're doing here, we're in a war against our afflictions. I mean, it's mentioned over and over again. We're arguing with our afflictions when we're analyzing. We're literally having an argument with our, almost the devil and the angel, right? We're arguing with our afflictions. We're saying, no, I won't do that. And more times you say, no, I won't do that, and don't do that, the easier it becomes to not do it. And then eventually, the thought to do it doesn't come, right? So the abstention causes the motivation to even be quelled, it says. So just by, abstaining from these things, it will quell the desire to do them. And so we have to make sure that we're combating the afflictions the way that the texts say that we should. Shantideva, I mean, we don't need to even, we go back to the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And Shantideva talks about someone who's in a sword fight, right? If they drop their sword, they don't just stand there and get cut. They pick it up really quickly. And if they've forgotten something, right? And that relates to what? If we're doing something and our afflictions are taking over, we need to get our mindfulness back, right? And pick up the sword of introspection, get our mindfulness back and start to look at what we need to adopt and what we need to abandon. So how do we learn what those things are? We learn what those things are by studying. What are the antidotes to the afflictions? What are the antidotes to anger? What are the antidotes to attachment? All of these things are presented in order for us to be able to eventually become Buddhas. But it really is like a fight that we're engaging in. Because since beginningless time, we've been wrong. We've been looking at things incorrectly. So we have to start to fight to try to get that correct view. We have to fight against the current, if you will, swim against the current of our ignorance. When we have all these wrong things in our mind and we just put a few right things in, the right things are really outnumbered. And we really have to give them kind of our attention and give them some power with some more medicine. And that's more study. We look at the Buddha like a doctor and the Dharma like a medicine, right? If we don't take the medicine, if we don't take what the Buddha said to do, we can't be cured of our illness, right? If we go to a regular doctor and we have an illness and they give us medicine and we don't take it, we aren't cured of our illness. If the Buddha is like a doctor and gives us the medicine to cure us of our sufferings, but we don't take it, then how can we possibly know what medicine it is we need to take unless we study? It's not possible. It's not possible to know all of the antidotes without studying what they are. They're not just going to come out of the sky. It just doesn't happen. I wish it did. I've really been waiting for it. I've been good. And, I've had this close connection. Really, it's just studying more than learning something you didn't know yesterday, right? And then you know more today and you have more wisdom today than you did yesterday. And then after 10 days, you have 10 more wisdoms if you do it like that. And they can be little tiny ones, right? Like every time I pick up the Lamrim Chemo now, I find like a little wisdom I didn't see before. Like a little something went away in my mind that was wrong. So that's what we're doing. We're trying to get these things away that are wrong. And when we look at a Namtar, that's what they're doing. That's why they're going through all these links, doing all of these very hard things, not because it's fun, because it's necessary. And, you know, but the Lam Rim is so clear that we need to start with where we're at, practice within the scope of where we're at, but make sure that we're making aspirations for the latter. So we'll kind of end there. I know we didn't talk that much about Atisha, but there were some specific points that I wanted to make about study. And Rinpoche and I have been talking about the importance of study, and also talking about just the beauty of the fact that we are part of this lineage. And then when we say these names, right, when we pass away, if we've been good practitioners, they'll say our names like that. And it's not like, oh, I want them to say my name. It means that I won't, that I'm not going to suffer ever again if they say my name. Right? Like that's a, like, it's like ordinary fame, like, oh, they were great singers. But like this kind of thing is they never had to suffer again. Right? So that's what's really amazing when we look at, that's the potential we have. They had a teacher that taught them the right thing and they never had to suffer again. We have a teacher teaching us the right thing. We don't have to suffer ever again. We just may choose to, but eventually we will have to put these things into practice if we want to be enlightened. And we look at this ideas that bodhisattvas have, that it's just such a big mindset, right? Where they give all their things away to sentient beings. They get to the point where they'll even give their bodies away if it's benefit. And that kind of huge mind mental state doesn't just come from nowhere. It comes from the building blocks of practice that get beings to those states that are very, very, very real and results. They are results. And when we look at the various stages of the pathways, when we look at various abandonments, those abandonments occur from antidotes. And then once there's a cessation, then we say is that's not a result, right? It's tough. The debaters around here, ears will perk up if I start talking about cessation of suffering and result. Because when we look at cessation, we say that these things all, like the path and so forth, we don't say that cessation is a result. We say that the path is what caused the absence of the suffering. Absence of something is permanent, right? Permanent things are not results, because so we'll leave that to the debaters. But yeah, anybody have any questions today? We'll get more into the greatness of the teaching and then the actual stages of practice, the actual body of the text soon. But it's, I think, important to talk a little bit about lineage masters, talk about how they relate to us, inspire us, and so forth. So real quickly, anybody who's new, when what the Lam Rim, I think everybody's been here, is there's stages of the path, we say, for beings of three capacities. Those three capacities are at the smallest level, beings who wish to abandon the lower realms of cyclic existence altogether. So it's said in the Lam Rim that those beings who only have that small scope of motivation, who only want to abandon the lower realms of cyclic existence, engage in going for refuge, abandoning the 10 non-virtues and acknowledging their downfalls. So the Buddha said, if you do these practices, then you'll be able to achieve rebirth in the higher realms. Buddhism divides realms into six categories, three lower realms, three higher realms. The three lower realms are hell, hungry, ghost, and animal. The three higher realms are human, demigod, and God. And the small scope teachings show a person how to only be born in those higher realms that we're speaking of. The medium scope teachings show a person how to be free from all of those realms of cyclic existence, how to get rid of those afflictive obstructions that cause a being to be in samsara, cause a being to be reborn again and again in those six realms. And according to the Lam Rim, the medium scope practitioner practices the three highest higher trainings, and in dependence upon ethics, concentration, and wisdom, he or she is able to achieve an abiding nirvana and abandon the afflictive obstructions. But they are not Buddhas yet. They are Hinayana, hearer or solitary realizer, foe destroyers in an abiding nirvana. They are not omniscient. They still have what are called the imprints of the afflictions, the obstructions to omniscience. So they're abiding in a nirvana. They don't have suffering, but they can't help all sentient beings. They haven't fulfilled all their own aims even because they're not omniscient. And because they're not omniscient, they can't help all sentient beings. So the next level is the great scope practitioner who wants to become a Buddha, who wants to get rid of all of the afflictions and their stains and their imprints, because he or she wants to help all sentient beings and wants to fulfill all his or her needs by becoming omniscient and others' needs by becoming omniscient. And then that practitioner engages in the practices that have just been mentioned and couples them with the six perfections and practices a union of method and wisdom. And when we look at Buddha Shakyamuni achieved the mind that aspired to enlightenment at the path of accumulation and then accumulated merit for three countless eons. And then when we look at the Lam Rim, based on what I just said, how do you get bodhicitta? Well, bodhicitta requires the teachings for beings of medium capacity to be generated. Because in the teachings for beings of medium capacity, we find renunciation. And it's necessary to have renunciation to develop bodhicitta. And in order to develop renunciation, you have to understand the smaller scope teachings. You have to understand samsara and understand the lower realms of cyclic existence and the kind of coarsest levels of suffering that you would want to abandon. So it all becomes, when we say it's kind of one interwoven path, it means that exactly. It means that we have these teachings that are in common and then these teachings that are a result of those things that are in common. So that is, go ahead.
Brian has a question.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning,
Rinpoche, Tashi Delay.
Brian.
I was listening to some teachings by the Dalai Lama, and he mentioned that most Buddhist schools do ascribe to the fact that the self is not inherently existent. However, then he said that some of the schools, I don't know if we should call them lower schools, but schools that are not the Madhyamaka ascribe to some inherent existence of the aggregates still. They hold on to some existent of phenomena or the aggregates. But right in the Heart Sutra, which I know all Buddhist schools, even Zen, etc., ascribe to, it says right in there that the skandhas or the aggregates are empty of nature. So I'm wondering why in some of the other schools they still ascribe to some inherent existence of the aggregates.
Rinpoche, the Jao Rinpoche Sonchen, then the Sonchen, the Dutta Mawa Gichi Shiegabu. Then Jao Rinpoche Sombre, the Dutta Kashe, the Da Yoba Yere, Dutta Kashe, the Da Meba Yere, Dutta Kashe Pumbo, Demba Drupa Yimba. Then the Brian, the Chiwa, the Garishine, the Kashe, the Pumbo, Demba Drupa Yimba Kalen, Gangisina, the Shirab Nimbo, the Pumbo, Pumbo, the Tomba Niyen, Kalengdu. Then Lenja Gare, the Teme, the Shirab Nimpo, Kalem Mare, Garshene, the Dutta Kashe, the Pumbo, Demba Drupa Yimba Kalem. The Teme Dutta. The Techen Dutta Kanga, the Pumbo Napo, the Demba Madrupa Yimbichir Kalem. Sansamba Dang, Uma. Nicha, Nika Yimba.
Yeah.
Okay, so when we're looking at the tenet systems, we have Vibhashika and Satrantika. These are considered the, when we look at their categories, right? We consider those two Hinayana schools. right? The followers of the Vaibhashika and the followers of the... Now, Mahayana teachers taught them, but we consider them, if we are going to put them in categories, right? We consider them the Hinayana teachings. Some Hinayanists, if not all, I'm not a scholar about history, right? Hinayanists, some, if not all, assert that the Heart Sutra is not a teaching of the Buddha. The first turning of the wheel is the only teaching of the Buddha. So in their tenet systems, they don't look at the Heart Sutra. But Rinpoche, I asked him this question, in the Chittamantran school and the Madhyamaka school, the middle way school, so the mind-only school and the middle way school, these are both considered Mahayana tenet systems. And both of those tenet systems assert that the aggregates are empty.
Okay.
So it's the Hinayanist view, the lower Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, you have 18 Vaibhashika schools. Five of them, I think, even assert a self. You need leave that to the scholars, right? But check into that. Like there's an assertion of some, the Shiramawa Juje, the Nga Da Yoga Yomarve. So five of them assert a self, an existing self. How or why or whatever, we'd have to look at those five, right, of the Vaibhashika school. But you see more and more kind of taken away in terms of what, more and more things become empty as you go further along in the tenets, right? So like in the lower tenets, they first start with the I because it's right here, right? Let's just talk about that. Let's talk about this I that's, you know, maneuvering, and we'll talk about the lack of the self of I. And then, well, but there's also this phenomena, right, out there. So as the tenet systems increase in wisdom, if you will, because that's really what it is. It's like, it's a graduated stages of wisdom in a way. I don't know if they're graduated stages, but they are, you know, I don't know that they're, but they are stages of wisdom. Of, you know, negating the most coarse thing to be negated up to the most subtle, right? That's what the tenets do. They start with the coarse and they end with the most subtle negations. So the lower schools didn't negate that yet. Yeah, interesting, right? So, but then Robert Thurman and a lot of other scholars and most scholars, you know, I say Robert Thurman because I heard he said it last. You know, say that when we look at the first turning of the wheel of Dharma and we look at the way that it was spoken three times, you know, suffering. So Buddha first states that this is the truth of suffering. This is the truth of origin. This is the truth of cessation. This is the truth of path. Then the Buddha says that suffering must be understood, that origin has to be abandoned, that cessation has to be achieved and path relied upon. Then the Buddha says, there is no suffering to understand. There is no origin abandoned. There is no cessation. Right? There's no cessation, and there's no path. So most scholars would assert Prasangika taught at the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. And most scholars would assert, because cessation is bliss, that highest yoga tantra was taught at the first turning of the wheel of Dharma in its implicit manner. Because bliss is taught, bliss is achieved through a cause, right? So most scholars would agree that implicitly that's being taught. But then if you look at what else was going on at the same time of the Heart Sutra, Kala Chakra was being taught. So the more subtle points of view were being taught simo by Shakyamuni. The same moment, Shakyamuni was teaching Kala Chakra and Heart Sutra, according to scripture. So it's very interesting, right? When we just see that just subtle negation. And that's it.
Okay.
So, it's, you know, we can compare all these texts, right? And we can say, well, huh, I wonder why the Hinayanists would say that. Well, they say, oh, there's no path the self sees. There's no, you know, there's no origin the self has to abandon, right? Mm-hmm. There's no cessation the self. There's no true self that has to abandon this or that. So then you start to kind of understand more about what you understand or don't understand too. I'm finding like really hard not to adhere to mind-only school view right now. I'm finding it hard with Tantra. I have to be, you know, frank. And I've heard Geshe say this, so I'm not going to like go in a closet and, you know, and feel bad about myself. But I'm having a really hard time right now. I know in theory and intelligence, but then when you start to like look at how everything is projected, it starts to get really tricky. How our karma's in things, and it gets tricky, you know, that our collective karma is making a tree. Like there's a little bit of me in the tree in order for the tree to be there, because if all sentient beings aren't here, there's no tree, right? So it starts to get tricky, and that's why we've really got to study these tenets, because if you're not a Buddha, there's still like things in there that obviously a bodhisattva on the eighth and ninth ground are abandoning imprints of these wrong ideas, right? So it's we've got to study. It goes back to that. We've really the importance of study. And you know, and it's like it's really easy to judge. Like this goes back to, it's funny, this goes back to not studying enough from my part. I've done this like a lot in Buddhism. Not studying enough. So like in some way, like I feel like, wow, how could they ever come to such a stupid conclusion that they couldn't see this or that? But I don't even know if I've come to that conclusion or not. Because I haven't studied enough to even know if I've come to that conclusion. Like, so it's real easy for me to say like, how could they think that? Because like, I have like the nugget of truth that's been handed to me. I was in Dharamsala. I'll never forget this. And there was just some stuff that went on. There was some people that, Rinpoche was a tough teacher, let's just say that. So like when I got to Dharamsala, a couple of like monks wanted to debate me and stuff, like wanted to just see, I don't know what it was about. But so I'm like literally like outside of a telephone stand and someone comes up to me and is like, so I was in robes at the time. No, you're a Western monk. Who are you? And I told them, and they were like, oh, what do you know, right? So I started like talking about the path of accumulation, because that was my go-to topic right then. I studied like 5 seconds of the Parshi. So I was like, I know these five paths. I can name them all. So because I can name these five paths and like kind of the divisions in them, I must know like a lot, right? So I'm in the like, in the street in Dharamsala, and these monks come up to like pick on me, what it seems like. They're my teachers, right? And they're like, well, what do you know? And I say, about these five paths. And they're like, what text that in? And I was like, well, my teacher told me. And they were like, your teacher could tell you anything. And they were like, well, what book is that in? What text that from? And they were like, what, did you leave all your books in your, and they say this at the debate courtyard too, if Lobsang's on, he's gonna laugh. When you can't answer, they said, did you leave all of your knowledge and your books in your box at home? When you can't answer, like, you great scholar, you must have left all your knowledge in your box of books at home, right? it's interesting how when you don't know what you don't know, I guess is what, and that's why the path is so extensive. That's why Nagarjuna wrote so many books about emptiness. He could have written, things are not truly established because they dependently originate. You know what I mean? That's it. All phenomena, that sums it up, are not truly established because they dependently originate, therefore they're empty. Why would he need to write more than that? Because there's so many things that come up. Well, maybe this isn't empty. Maybe that's empty. What do you mean empty? Oh, that's empty? What are the ramifications of that? So that really is a need for all of this kind of research I'm finding into the afflictions and into the antidotes and into view, especially view, and also the six perfections I'm finding, those are really easy to come off my lips, but then study them in the Lam Rim Chemo. You know, think about ethics. Think about what the perfection of ethics really means, you know, abstaining from anything that can harm another being or being involved in anything that can harm them. That's what you're striving ethically to do. you know, and then the teachers say that it's really those seven of the body and the speech that you're stopping, right? You're acting out with, you're saying, and you're acting out with. So it's really those seven things that can harm people directly and indirectly. You know, your mind will think about it, but it's your voice and your body that's going to carry it out. So stopping that, what does that mean? What would that mean? If non-harm, complete non-harm that you're engaged in or indirectly engaged in, you know? And then you're like, you know, so we eat meat? Like, you know, so we, you know, think about some but not others in terms of who we care for or who we're willing to bring to enlightenment, right? The Bodhisattva looks at the individual liberation vows and keeps the vows, the same vows a Hinayana practitioner keeps. The Bodhisattva holds like this, because the Bodhisattva is terrified that he or she won't be able to help sentient beings as quickly as possible by engaging in any of those things that Hinayana abstain from. He or she will fall to a lower realm where they won't be able to be as helpful. Bodhisattvas can go to hell. Bodhisattvas can become hungry ghosts. It's not until you burn the seeds up at the path of a preparation, patience stage, where you have an inferential valid cognition of emptiness, that you're not born again into the lower realms. So the Bodhisattva guards those things that throw you in, you know, those practices that could cause him or her to be born into the lower realms, like their eyes, you know. So the Hinayana practices, we say lesser vehicle. Is that lesser? It's more greater than me. Right? Like, you know, like I look at the realization of the Hinayana. It's much, I can say Hinayana because that's what it's named, but I better not look down on it because it's a much higher realization than I have. Renunciation? Perfect Vinaya? So it's just important that we put into perspective where we're at, put into perspective that we probably don't know as much as we think we do, and then start to study so that we can know more. And then when we start to study, we're going to realize we didn't know what we thought we knew. And that's the process of pulverizing the tahini seeds, right? The sesame seeds to make tahini, you know? Just, that's the process.
Thank you.
Of course. So even the Madhyamaka schools, some of them grasp at true establishment still. We have the middle way school, this, you know, the big school, you know, it has the consequence and then it has the autonomy school, and then autonomy breaks down into two, one that's kind of like the sutra school and one that's kind of like the mind only school. Only the prasangika school, the consequence school, that final top view of the Madhyamaka, doesn't grasp at true establishment in some way. So even though they don't say the aggregates, there's still some, you know, a good debater might even say they're grasping at the aggregates because they believe the aggregates and the namer, the aggregates have some defining characteristic that can call them aggregates. So I wonder if at a subtle level, it'd be great to do this debate, right? Like fully, like at a subtle level, if the middle way autonomy school is still grasping at the aggregates, the Rinpoche, the Chishin, the Sheramawa, the Dodepa, the Sansampa, Uma, the Uma, Kenjo, Ranjupa, the Ranjupa, the Denzin, that's a Yuri, Gangin Sena, the Kon Seni, Yomaribe, signlessness. Then konsu the sampa then la mingda dang pombo yamdu then pom yongdu. Then konsu chi shena the pombo jambo drupa that's shindu kelendu yomarbe. The umaran jupa pombo la that's jambo drupa kelendu. Seni yoba yomarbe.
I don't want to assert it as definite because I'm not sure if Rinpoche is sleepy or not, but yeah, I think, you know, if you're stating that the middle way autonomy school is still adhering to inherent existence, then, you know, and they're saying that there's a defining characteristic that's of the thing that we're labeling, and it takes both the object and the subject in order for it to come into being, there's still grasping there, no? So is Lobsang on? No. Oh, this would be his territory for sure. It'd be his lane.
He's on his way to DNKL.
Oh, okay.
Not here this morning. Yeah.
Yeah, so these are things we don't have to have the answer today though, right? We can study and then, you know, Arya Davis said that it's the just even having doubt about emptiness, right? Shakes cyclic existence, like makes an earthquake. Like, are things empty or not? Maybe they are empty. Someone says that even, it shakes samsara. So imagine how wonderful it is if you're like, well, I wonder if the autonomy school still has grasping a true establishment. I mean, that's wonderful, right? That we're wondering that. It's wonderful that we like even have this information we wonder about. And we need to just make aspirations to be able to know it later if we don't know it now. And understand Buddhism is huge and it goes all the way up to this very subtle level. And people, bodhisattvas on the fifth ground can't do what bodhisattvas on the sixth ground do, right? So we should give ourselves a little bit of a break if the bodhisattvas are a little inept at times, right? Bodhisattvas, you know, they're inept. The seventh ground bodhisattva would be like, man, I remember when I was on the sixth ground, man. I could not help people the way I can help them now. I don't know who that guy was or who that girl was. So it's we're always moving forward and progressing, hopefully, right? And the other thing, I was talking with Don in Rhode Island about, he's studying a lot of the sutras these days and a lot of the 84,000 kind of teaching. There's a lot of these being translated now. The word, like the Buddha's daily life, all the stories. And we were talking about how yesterday, what I did and what I did 10 lifetimes ago, they're equal, right? They're both before, they're both something I planted, and they're both things I can only purify or not do again if they're negative. They're not something that, like yesterday's Jeff doesn't even exist anymore. All I have is right now, right? All I have is right now. And I think that's really important to put into perspective with practice. Like, oh, I didn't do my six session guru yoga for so many years. Well, but then I started to, right? So many years, so many lifetimes, I didn't even meet Buddhism. And I did so many terrible things, you know. I've murdered and been murdered, right? And so I have to put that into perspective. That what I did yesterday is relevant because I can say if it was negative, I don't want to do that anymore, and I want to move forward. But it's not something that really has a major impact on today in terms of continuity of practice, if you will. Because I think anybody who has practiced a lot and then given it up and then goes back to it, it takes a very short period of time to kind of get right back where you left off in a groove. Maybe a week, maybe a week and a half, and you're right back in that groove where you kind of left off. And that just goes to show you that, like, yeah, you didn't do it for that time, but now you're here and you can start to do it again. Now you can, you know, take this morning and read a chapter of the Lam Rim. You know, you didn't do it yesterday, so what? You know, be like, I regret not doing it yesterday. Okay, I'm going to make a commitment. I'm going to read it today. It's that simple,
right? It's that simple. And I think that sometimes we get so hard on ourselves and we look at like the Galupa teachings, especially, and like all the stuff to know. And it's like, all right, I can't possibly know all of this. This is too much. This is too much information. This is, you know, I just won't do anything. And it's just about putting one foot in front of the other. You know, it's just about making sure you have a framework and putting one foot in front of the other. We have the framework, so the rest is up to us. No more questions? So let's do the dedication. The fundamental ground is scented with incense and strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, the four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha land and offer it. May all sentient beings enjoy this pure realm. I dedicate whatever virtues I have collected for the benefit of the teachings and of all sentient beings, in particular for the essential teachings of Venerable Lozen Drapa to shine forever. I send forth this jeweled mandala to you, precious. I dedicate all this virtue to emulate the knowledge of the hero Manjushri and likewise Samantabhadra as well. Whatever dedication is praised as supreme by all the conquerors who traverse the three times, I also dedicate all my roots of virtue for the sake of auspicious deeds. In that pure land surrounded by snowy mountains, you are the source of all benefit and happiness. All powerful Avalokiteshvara Tenzin Gyatso, may you stay until samsara's end. I pray for the long life of the precious Tensor Wanda, upholder of scriptural and realizational doctrines, a spiritual friend who trained extensively in the five great philosophical texts, with exceptional wisdom and perseverance. Okay, everybody, thank you so much. And we'll see you White Tara initiation next week. So thanks again, everybody. And I hope this was of some benefit.